This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. I am still grieving and trying to process the events of Wednesday, January 6, 2021, to borrow a phrase, a day that will live in infamy. The thing I believe I am most obsessed about is if half of the country knew that such a thing was at least latent, if not inevitable, how could we have done better communicating? And how can we communicate now to both bring about justice and healing? That will be the work for those of us in the United States for some time to come. On a happier note, I'd like to thank my new supporters, James G. and Ray G. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. I think I'm going to begin to call all of you supporters friends of the podcast. So further friends of the podcast with Libby N., James T., John G., adding Ray G., Joel W., and adding James G. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast. I also want to thank new raters and reviewers, Grobe 34 and Troy MH. Thank you for rating and reviewing the podcast. That means so much. I also want to thank Mike T for joining the team and doing some editing. This is the first episode where he has done the editing for me. Mike will be an ongoing part of the team, and I am excited to start working with him. On to today's show. My guest this week is James. James is a former missionary to Haiti. He was in the Pentecostal and charismatic traditions. He is self-described as a very sensitive person. He says about himself that he was very sensitive to God speaking in his life. And James provides a really necessary perspective. This is more of the emotional experience of Christianity. And James tells it with such rawness and honesty that I think you're going to be powerfully changed as you hear his story. This is a Deconversion Anonymous episode. If you are going through a faith transition and would like to tell your story, please send me an email at gracefulatheist@gmail.com. Here's my conversation with James. James, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being willing to tell your story. So let's begin at the beginning. What was your faith tradition like when you were growing up and or when you were at your most faithful?
Okay. Well, that's actually two different questions in my case.
Okay.
So I was born into a multi-generational Southern Baptist family, going back at least four generations that I'm aware of. My great-grandfather was an ordained Baptist minister who was a chaplain in the armed forces during World War II. On my mom's side, of course. My dad's side did not take religion as seriously for many generations. I don't know how much, I can't say how much that informed my thinking in later years because I was mostly raised by my mom. Had a pretty not out of religious obligation, just more logistical. My mom was the one who did most of the raising us, and my dad was always working like crazy. Struggled a lot financially when I was younger, and so he was always focused more on work, just logistically. My mom always wanted to work, but it was the kind of thing where it was just more financially viable for her to stay home with us than to have a job and put us in like daycare or after school programs or anything else.
You've just described the American condition, but yes, I hear you.
Right. I'm in that same condition right now, actually, with my own kids. But yeah, so mostly for logistical reasons, I was a lot closer with my mom growing up. And so her religious tradition and her side of the family definitely informed a lot more of that when I was younger. And so, born Baptist, spent most of my formative years in pseudo-Baptist traditions.
Sure, sure.
Not Baptist in name, like churches that say like Bible church in the name, or, you know, independent churches that weren't technically Baptist, but doctrinally were very similar to Baptist in terms of theology.
Yeah, I find this the fascinating trend in churches. Like, you know, everything is non-denominational, quote unquote, but under the hood, it's Baptist.
Right, right. I think I get the sense that a lot of non-denominational groups, you know, theologically they're basically Baptist, but they want to avoid like the prohibitions against dancing or the prohibitions against like complete the rule about complete abstinence from alcohol. You know, they don't want to carry that baggage, but in terms of basic theology, they're still pretty Baptist.
Right.
So that was pretty much all of my formative years up until late high school and college. When I went to college, I became involved with a campus organization that was adjacent to Assemblies of God,
mm-hmm.
which some of your listeners probably already know this, but they are like Pentecostal light. So very much into charismatic movement, the gifts of the Spirit, speaking in tongues. But, you know, they don't require, Assemblies of God churches don't require women to grow their hair down to the floor and only wear skirt.
Yeah. But quite a change from Baptist. Yes.
But, you know, in terms of theology and practice and service, very, very Pentecostal like. And so that really, when we talk about my faith being at the strongest, that was something that very much appealed to me when I was that age.
What age was that?
So this was like late high school, early college.
Okay.
When I started experiencing these sorts of services, you know, I'm someone who is very, it's not difficult for me to get swept up in big emotional moments, especially when there's music and story and everything else yeah. involved. I'm very sensitive to that sort of thing. I mean, if a certain movie, a certain story is touching, you know, it may be the 10th time I've seen it and I still will tear up if it really is something that resonates with me. So, you know, I'm definitely yeah. the kind of person. So
you're officially a human being. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I feel even more so than people I associate with. I definitely cry easier than most people I know. So that's something that I was very sensitive to, the sort of charismatic movement, the charismatic service, you know, very, very much invested in the idea that, you know, that God was speaking to me directly. You know, I had visions and I had stirrings in my heart where I felt like God was leading me one way or the other. So, and it was all 100% real to me.
Yeah.
It's still, when I think back, when I put myself in those memories, looking back, it still kind of blows me away that I reached the point where I'm at now.
Yeah.
Because I was never someone who really entertained like doubts and skepticism for my entire youth and young adult life. The idea of being non-Christian or non-religious, even more so, was just not something that ever occurred to me as a possibility. It was all very real, very, very present. It could completely fill my mind and my heart and just consume my life in that way. So yeah, it's still kind of strange. It's been about 3 years since I fully admitted to myself that I was not a Christian anymore, but it still seems strange when I think about my young adult years.
Well, this is an important point in that, you know, we often, I don't know about you, James, but when, you know, I'm talking to the believers in my life, my friends and family, one of the hardest things to describe to them is how convinced I used to be, right? That, you know, I was 100% in, and there's a tendency from some of our friends and family who are believers to say, well, maybe you were never, you know, a real Christian. So I think what you're expressing is that total dedication that just, it's unfathomable to you just several years ago that you would be where you are today.
Right. Yeah, no, that's very, on the one hand, that's extremely frustrating, and it can definitely be insulting for someone to say, well, you never really believed. And so I hear something like that and I can get very frustrated. I could even feel insulted, but you know, I'm someone who's deeply interested in studying human psychology. And that was actually a significant part of my eventual deconversion. That sort of denial makes complete sense. You know, it's cognitive dissonance. If somebody who was fully faithful, fully committed, fully convinced, on fire for God, as they would say, can eventually get to a place where they say, I no longer believe that, then that raises the uncomfortable question of, well, could that happen to me? Like, that's something a believer could ask themselves. And so rather than face and confront that question, as uncomfortable as it is, if you can dismiss the deconversion of someone else by saying, oh, well, you never really believed in the first place, then they no longer have to contend with that discomfort in themselves. They can avoid the cognitive dissonance that way. So I understand why people do that, but it is very frustrating to try to help believers understand, yes, I really did believe it. And do you understand how, you know, condescending you're being right now, dismissing my experiences, thinking you know what's in my head better than I did?
The obvious next question is, it was unfathomable to you just a few years ago, but what began to make that slightly more fathomable? How did the cracks begin to show?
I'm not sure where to begin here.
Yeah, take your time.
It's the weirdest thing about breaking all this down is the difference between the experience as it was happening and looking back in hindsight and seeing things from right now. Because I could say that, like, looking back, even as a kid, like, I was always asking questions. I was always very curious.
Yeah.
I was never one to be satisfied by because I said so or just because. Like, you know, I really wanted to know and understand. And but sorry, I'm getting a little overwhelmed right now.
Yeah, it's okay. Let me help you out just a bit. I like to distinguish between the death by a thousand paper cuts, you know, all there's little tiny things that happen all along the way. And then there might be some final straw that we often point to and go, oh, well, that was the thing. And yet it may be that it's not just the one thing, it's a lot of things, and you just become aware of it at some point.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, let's focus on the, I guess, the major blows. It was several. So in my mid-20s, I actually became an international missionary with a very charismatic mission organization. I mean, our training for going on this missionary journey was very much, you know, we're going to practice prophesying over each other, and we're going to make bold declarations about how we're going to go out there and raise the dead. Like, it was full tilt, like early church in Acts. Like, we're going to do the things they did. We're going to step into that promise where, you know, Jesus said, you will do everything that I have done and more. Like, we're going to fulfill that promise, and we're going to change the world.
Yeah.
So that was in my mid-20s, and it was an extended missionary journey. You dedicate a whole year, and you travel to multiple countries during that time. And one of the countries I traveled to was Haiti.
Okay.
This was less than a year after the 2010 earthquake. You can't overemphasize how much of a disaster this was. You know, Haiti's architecture and infrastructure is not what we're used to in a place like the United States. And so, you know, so many people died and so many people were displaced. Like, there was people living in tent cities like the size of football fields or bigger. Our local context were telling stories about how, you know, some mothers, if they didn't have any food, they would make dirt cookies, where they'd take a tiny amount of cooking oil and mix it with soil and, you know, pat it together into a sort of cake. And then the kids would eat this, not because it gave them any nutritional value, but just because having something in their stomach would quell the hunger pains.
Wow.
And so being there and seeing this devastation, it really sent me to a place of, like, you know, going back to how seriously I took my faith, you know, especially since I was always kind of interested in philosophy and psychology. And, you know, I was studying apologetics techniques even when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that God is all powerful, you know, and that he works all things together for the good, like Romans says, if you really take in this idea, then it kind of follows that chaos doesn't really exist. Like, chaos is an illusion, because if God is all powerful and God is in control and he works all things together for his plan and his purpose, then what we perceive to be chaos is just because we don't see his plan. So I can't say that the way I'm phrasing it right now, I can't say that I was taught this idea in those exact words, but just the ideas that I'd been taught for so many years about God's power and his sovereignty and his plan very much instilled that paradigm in my head. Like, chaos does not actually exist. It's an illusion. God is in control.
Oftentimes, apologists want to have it both ways. They want to say that God is a God of order and justice and righteousness, and at the same time, they also want to say, but human beings are sinful, and so there's things go wrong in the world. And I always feel like, you know, the God that apologists believe in is kind of neutered and powerless. And what you're describing, James, is the way that I understood God, right? If, like, if you believe that this is the all-powerful creator of the universe, you have some expectations about what that is going to look like. And that's right. What it sounds like.
Describing. Right. And even now, like, you know, there's going to be some other steps along this same path, but hypothetically speaking, even if I was a Christian now, I could accept, and I never had an issue with, the idea that evil exists because of human action. Like, the idea that you know, if we're going to have free will, we have to have the ability to choose evil. So, like, that was not an issue. But, you know, when you talk about things that don't happen because evil, or, you know, suffering more specifically, that happens that has nothing to do with human choice, like a natural disaster, you know, even something like cancer, you could say, well, they smoked for 40 years. What do you expect? But, you know, what about a child born with cancer?
Mm. Yeah.
Where is the human choice of evil that bears that fruit? I don't see that. How does that work? So.
Agreed.
So yeah, being on that missionary journey and, you know, seeing people with just such dramatically different life circumstances than what was to me normal growing up in the United States in a middle class life, that really opened my eyes to just how big and complicated and complex and varied the world is. It was much harder to maintain the idea that my faith was this sort of one size fix all solution to everything. It's like, it really broadened my perspective on, you know, just how different people are and how different parts of the world are. And even though I didn't, you know, again, at the time, it just kind of rocked me and disturbed me and had me asking questions like, God, where are you in all this?
Yeah,
I'm having trouble seeing you. And I wasn't saying he's not here. I was saying, I'm having trouble believing that you have a plan for this.
Right.
That this is part of your plan. I can't see it. Now, I resorted back to, you know, I'm a human being. I'm finite. You're infinite. And it didn't break my faith, but it definitely planted the seed in my mind that, you know, maybe sometimes shit just happens.
Yes. Exactly.
And so I guess that was on some level the point where I could no longer deny that chaos existed, that it was a thing, that by all, like as far as I could understand, you know, some things in this world just happen and there's no like rhyme or reason or even will behind it. It just happens, especially things like natural disasters. That was the first big blow. And I think that everything afterwards kind of grew out of that.
You are not the first person who's come on to say that they were a missionary and seeing life out in the real world.
Oh, no, of course not.
That is a super common story, that you go out with preconceived ideas about what the world looks like and what God's going to do in the world, and then reality smacks you upside the face. And it is quite a disturbing experience.
Right. Well, what brought me to your podcast was your interview with Karen from Deconversion Therapy.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And
she has a story like that.
Right.
About how being a missionary changed her thinking about everything. I think that was the first shift. So, ended up coming home from missionary journey early. I didn't do the full year because we ran out of funding.
Okay.
So me and my wife, we actually went on this journey together, and we both came back after just a few months. Very quickly found by surprise that we were going to have a baby. And so thus began the transition to family life. Going into the working world for me was incredibly hard. I work in a high stress field.
Okay.
And it's a field that I kind of stumbled into. Not something I set out to do. I'll go ahead and say it. I got an English degree without any thought to what I was going to do with an English degree. I just know that I liked okay. reading. I liked writing, and I liked doing essays about symbolism and metaphor and everything else.
Yeah.
Then after graduating, it's like, well, what do you do with an English degree? Well, you can teach English in high school, in middle school. And so that's what I ended up doing. Like, my personality does not jive well with being a school teacher, especially for teenagers.
Okay.
So that was a really rough place to be for. It wasn't so bad when I was at small private schools, but small private schools don't pay very well compared to public schools. So as soon as I went to the public system and I started really getting into, you know, the high stress world of public education, it really started to take a toll on my mental health. In part, this is the thing that really changed my thinking later on. In part because of my Christian faith, I had never really developed good coping skills.
Right.
With very intense emotional states. You know, I took the, you know, give it to God and cast all your cares on him, for he cares for you. Like, that was something that I took very strongly to heart. And so, you know, I'm a personality that experiences very powerful emotional states, very intense emotional states. And so that was not something that I ever really learned to manage on my own.
Okay.
Because, you know, I could always just pray and kind of get it off my shoulders.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, in my mid to late 20s, but psychologically, I was still kind of arrested around 16, 17, where I really started to have some unpleasant experiences with dating and breakups and all kinds of stuff. And so I just kind of got stuck in that place, and I didn't experience the sort of emotional maturation that I needed to generally, not even, you know, much less the emotional maturation you need to handle a high stress work environment like public school teaching.
Yeah.
And so the next experience that really made, like, shook me along the line came a few years later when I was in public school teaching, and I was in a really rough place. I was having panic attacks. I just was not doing well. And, you know, my whole life going up back to when I was experiencing charismatic traditions, you know, I could almost at will close my eyes, say a prayer, and like feel the presence of the Holy Spirit. You know, that was something that was very real and just at my fingertips. And so when I was in this, you know, fighting panic attack state, I tried to do that and it didn't work.
Ah.
I was not able, like, I cried out to God, not to make my students like go easy on me, not to give me a different job, like nothing like that. All I wanted was, you know, the peace that passes understanding. You know, just some peace. And so, you know, I closed my eyes and I cried out to God in prayer for it, and it didn't come. Like, it didn't happen. I didn't have that feeling of like the Holy Spirit moving from the crown of my head down my body like I had become accustomed to. And I'm like, so that kind of made me stop for a second and be like, what is going on? Like, this has never happened before. I've never been in a state where I'm just unable to feel God's peace and his presence. So, you know, at the time I was starting to feel like God had abandoned me when I needed him most.
Right.
Or that maybe I had done something terrible to cut me off from God. And then, you know, in hindsight, I think that, you know, we can talk later about the nature of spiritual experiences, which, you know, I'm endlessly fascinated by. I think that whatever anyone wants to call that sort of experience, that feeling that you get in your mind and your body, you know, I was in such a state of anxiety that I was unable to have that experience whenever I was looking for it. And so, yeah, that was really bad. And so, around this same time, so, you know, there was the missionary experience, and then a few years later there was this rough public school experience. And as I was getting out into the working world, I was starting to get to know people from very different backgrounds to my own, and I was noticing something interesting, that a lot of the non-religious people that I was crossing paths with, it wasn't universal, obviously, but a lot of the religious people, the non-religious people that I was interacting with, in some cases, they were kinder, more generous, more patient, and more understanding. Like, they, in a lot of cases, I was meeting non-religious people who exemplified what I would consider Christian virtues more than a lot of Christians I had known.
Right.
And so, you know, again, at the time I didn't really think too much about it, but, you know, I think that planted a seed in my mind that, you know, maybe, you know, this idea that Christianity has this unique power that's unlike anything else to transform you into, you know, just a better person. Maybe Christianity isn't so special.
Right.
You know, when people of other faiths and people of non-faith can exhibit these qualities just as well, in some cases more so. So those, you know, those three major benchmarks, the being a missionary, having, you know, severe anxiety and struggling mm-hmm. with my mental, emotional health and feeling disconnected from God, and then meeting people, meeting non-Christians and forming working relationship with non-Christians. These planted the seeds, but I didn't go into a serious period of doubt and questioning until my daughter, who was just shy of 2 years old at the time, was diagnosed with leukemia.
Oh man, James, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to say that she's made a full recovery. All of her prognosis has been great ever since she finished treatment. So
wonderful.
Yeah. That was, yeah, it was the weirdest thing. Like, I didn't get mad at God. Mm-hmm. I just started asking, you know, the big whys. And I had encountered apologetic before. If you'd asked me before it happened to my child, what does this mean? Why does God let this happen? My answer would have been, well, we live in a fallen world. And, you know, disease is a part of that. But that's a lot easier pill to swallow when it's not your own child.
Man, I can't imagine, James.
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy. So just as a quick aside, you know, there's kind of a theme here of, there was a lot of ideas that it seems like I was only able to really maintain from a position of privilege.
Right.
You know, that I hadn't experienced directly. Like, I hadn't experienced poverty directly until I went to Haiti, and I hadn't experienced what it was like to have a different religion or no religion inform your thinking until I worked with people who were very different than myself.
Right.
It was much easier to accept ridiculous tragedies like children who get cancer at a young age when it wasn't my own child.
Yeah.
So, like I said, I didn't get mad. It was all way too overwhelming. So just the reality of, you know, grappling with this medical situation and how it changed our lives. I mean, I took like over a month off of work. You know, my wife stayed in the hospital with our daughter 24/7. And, you know, my days were consumed with taking care of our son, our older son, mm-hmm. doing lots of laundry. Because I basically had to go visit them in the hospital every like twice a week to like bring them clean clothes, bring them groceries. So, you know, my life was just full of errands basically all day, every day while they were in the hospital. So just the realities of the treatment combined with the existential realities of like, what does this mean? Like, why? How? I don't understand how this could be part of the plan. And so I actually just, I didn't really think about it. Mm-hmm. I kind of disassociated from the whole thing. And I told myself, like, what do I need to do today? Like, today I need to go to the grocery store. I need to do two loads of laundry. I need to drop my son off here because he's staying with a friend while I go down to the hospital. And then I need to go to the hospital, drop off the clean clothes and the groceries, get the dirty clothes back. I need to bring that back here. I need to pick up my son and bring him home. Like, just thinking about the day ahead and thinking about the next thing I need to do. And when I did have moments where my brain wanted to really think about what it meant in terms of faith and God and everything else, the thing that really got me through and just kind of settled everything for me to where it was manageable was, you know what? I know that I love my family. And I know I need to do what is good for my family. And anything that there could be said about God and whether he's there or not doesn't really change that. Like, if you could prove to me that God is real and that, you know, any doubts or insecurities or questions I have are unfounded, or if you could prove to me that God is not real and all my doubts and insecurities are completely justified, like, regardless of which of those two things you were to present to me right now, it would not change what I need to do and why I need to do it.
Your whole family was in survival mode.
Right.
Your daughter in the obvious sense, and you and your wife to take care of everybody, and you were surviving. You did what you had to do.
Yeah. And so, you know, knowing this is what I need to do for us to make it through, and of course I'm going to do it because I love my family, and there is no religious idea or lack thereof that can change that reality. Like, that's what kind of just gave me a position to just kind of make it through. You know, during this time, I wasn't praying. I wasn't reading the Bible. Yeah, I was just focused on the day-to-day. And so, you know, sometimes I tell people it took a few months living like an agnostic to realize that maybe I wanted to be one.
Yeah.
So that was, that was the place I was in. And it was, and even that was not the final blow. Because once I got out of that survival mode, I tried to, you know, I tried to talk to people about my questions, and I sort of went back and forth on the idea, and I was definitely still attached to the idea that God was real. You know, it was complicated by the fact that, you know, both mine and my wife's parents are Christian. And pretty much everybody we knew in our social circle was Christian. And so there was definitely a social incentive to not leave that. And I'm not going to discuss my wife's experiences at all. I'm just going to leave it at, you know, we each went through our individual journeys as far as all this is concerned. And our journeys were not in tandem.
Okay. Yeah. Understood.
You know, I would be in a certain place asking certain questions, and it would make her uncomfortable. And then sometimes it would be the other way around. And we were pretty much never on the same page with the stuff. So we couldn't really talk to each other about it for, you know, all this time. And so it took about 2 years after diagnosis for me to eventually come to a place of saying, whether or not God is real, what I was taught about God does not hold up for me. I finally planted a flag of saying, I do not accept Christian orthodoxy. I was not willing to say that I don't believe in God. I wasn't willing to say I'm not a Christian, but I was at least willing to say, there are some things generally accepted across the broad consensus of Christian denominations, some basic stuff about the nature of God and the world and sin and reality that I don't accept.
Right.
So, you know, especially thing like the big one was, of course, like, you know, God's absolute sovereignty, that everything is a part of the plan. I'm like, no, everything. Like, as far as I can understand and everything that I can know experientially and empirically, it seems to me that sometimes shit just happens and it's not part of a plan. It just happens. And so that was my first major break, was saying, like, you know, I reject orthodoxy, you know, orthodox doctrine and dogma. I can't accept that.
Right.
I still wanted to call myself a Christian. I definitely still wanted to have faith in God, but as far as mainstream church teachings about the nature of God and reality, I was like, I'm not on board with that anymore.
Right. I just want to say that's a real, I mean, I completely understand that first step. You're not making some metaphysical statement about the nature of reality. You're just saying, you know, what I've been taught hasn't lined up with reality at this point.
Right. Yeah, it was just kind of the realization that, hey, this basic frame, this basic skeleton of theology that I've been taught my whole life, it really only works if you don't ask certain questions.
Yeah.
And you don't follow certain logical pathways that come out of it. And so, yeah, I got to a place where I couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once I made that move, you know, where I wasn't afraid of, I guess when I wasn't afraid of heresy anymore, I was finally opened myself up to things that I had shied away from my whole life, where I, you know, I started learning more about, you know, how the brain works and about the theory of evolution and mm-hmm. about the astronomical origins of the universe. And, you know, I'd always been interested in philosophy and apologetic, but it was always from the Christian side. You know, it was that sort of,
yeah,
that sort of presuppositional, I already know what I want to be true. Let me find things that can bolster that and can counter the argument against. But, you know, now without that sort of fear of asking certain questions, you know, I really started to digest some, you know, different podcasts, different lectures and TED Talks from speakers like Sam Harris. I know he's extremely controversial to some. As far as just kind of highlighting the evolutionary origins of morality and, mm-hmm. You know, debunking a lot of our assumptions about how the brain works, like that really expanded my thinking about the nature of faith and the nature of right and wrong.
Right.
And then it was around 2017, I would say, when I officially said, there's no way I can call myself a Christian anymore, even a heterodox Christian.
Right.
I cannot honestly bear that label. And so that's pretty much brings us up to the present. I mean, that was okay. A few years ago. And ever since then, I've been, you know, continually learning about different religions, you know, that were very yeah. different to my own. And just, you know, digesting a lot of information and ideas that were just off the table before.
Yeah.
I'm very invested in trying to help others where I can. One of the things that helped me during this last little stretch between, you know, when I said I can't call myself a Christian anymore to where I am now is I found the ex-Christian subreddit.
Yeah.
Being able to read other people's stories and share my own experiences and, you know, something like that, and you realize just how not alone you are.
Yeah.
You know, that was huge for me. And I actually eventually created my own more specialized subreddit.
Okay.
Because the general ex-Christian subreddit, I mean, it's a general hub, so.
And it's massive. A lot of people.
Right. It's enormous. So. You know, I was really more interested in the stuff like people's personal stories and talking about, you know, the philosophy and the psychology of faith and what it means and the sort of deconversion journey. Like that was much more my thing, you know, but the ex-Christian subreddit is also a place for people to post just like outright mockery and derision of
right.
religion and everything having to do with religion. And so, you know, I created my own subreddit called Ex-Christian Recovery, where I basically said, okay, we're just going to focus on personal stories and, you know, the deconversion process. You know, we're not going to do mockery. We're not going to be derisive about if somebody wants to be a heterodox Christian or somebody wants to join a different religion. You know, we're not going to comment on that. We're just going to focus on people who were raised in little O Orthodox, not specifically Greek Orthodox, little O Christian orthodoxy and yeah. have come out of it and how it's affected them. So that's that's something that I'm very, very invested in.
That's fantastic. I think one of the hardest things after you go through this process, and you basically described it, right? The first things you find out are, you know, it's just that information gathering, you're reading books, you're listening to podcasts, and maybe you're angry for a while and you kind of, you know, get into the angry atheist memes or what have you, or, you know, whatever. But about 15 minutes after that, you're like, okay, well, now what? And it sounds like you found, you know, an outlet for that to actually do something good in the world.
And, you know, along that same line, the one area where I do get angry, like even still,
sure,
is when it can be just general people or specifically Christian therapists give terrible psychological advice.
Yes.
That is one area, like, as I've learned, I've actually been in psychological therapy for many years and, you know, learning, and it's, it was with a secular therapist.
Okay.
Grappling with, you know, certain depression or anxiety issues that I've dealt with for years and years and years, coming at that from, you know, here's what we know about how the mind works, and seeing just how much more peace and wholeness that gave me compared to the sort of advice that you tend to get about that sort of thing in the church.
Right.
Yeah, that really just turned me on to psychology. Like, it's one of my favorite subjects in the whole world. Maybe my favorite, period.
We here at the podcast are very pro secular therapists. So good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And so that is the one area where I'll get angry at Christian religion, is when just absolutely awful psychological advice is given through the lens of the faith. Like, oh, you need to pray more, or, you know, read these Bible verses, or, you know, just general platitudes of like, you know, you're not alone, God is with you. It's like,
yeah,
one, you don't really understand how depression works, do you?
Yeah.
And two, like, that's not how you go about making depression better. Is, you know, someone says that they feel despairing and lonely, and you just tell them, you're not alone, God is with you. It's like, okay, you don't have to take a stand on the existence of God to say that we know enough about psychology that that's not how you help someone who's depressed.
Right. You know, you said something earlier, and I want to tie these together just a little bit. So we were talking about when post-deconversion, our friends and family might suggest that we were never real Christians. And part of that is as a defense mechanism, because if we were real Christians and we lost our faith, it's possible that they could someday. I think something very similar happens when real tragedy, when real suffering, real human pain occurs, in that the church, their response can be these pat answers, and it is self-protecting, church-protecting, and it's more protecting the narrative of the church than it is actually connecting with empathy for the person who's actually going through the suffering.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, going back to, you know, when I was meeting people who weren't Christians, who had what I would have called, you know, stronger Christian character than some Christians I knew. Mm-hmm. What really jumped out at me was like that they were often willing to just kind of meet me where I was, and, you know, their desire to help, if that was their response, it didn't seem to be coming from like there was no parallel motive. There was no other agenda. And mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people have, you know, especially the people who've suffered directly from religious people more than I have, you know, they get very angry about, you know, ulterior motives. It's like, mm-hmm. you don't actually care about me. You're just going through the motions of caring about me because you want to make sure that I don't lose my faith, or I don't change my mind about church teaching or any of that. But it's such a weird thing. Like, even Christians, I've known Christians who, even though they do care, they have to care just as much, if not more, about you know, making sure that the person stays on the straight and narrow, you know, it's like,
right.
Even if they are very, you know, empathetic and they want to help, the sort of, you know, back of your mind thing was, you know, nothing is more important than making sure that this person's soul is heaven bound. You know, that's kind of, you know, even among very sympathetic and generous and caring Christians, that's kind of like, it's kind of hanging over all of their altruism.
Yes. I've got a few questions for you. Let's start with the less emotionally fraught ones.
Okay.
So you've hinted at learning a bit about psychology and you have maybe a different perspective on your spiritual experiences. Do you want to delve into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, during that sort of liminal phase where I was like, you know, where I had rejected orthodoxy, little o orthodoxy, but I hadn't yet abandoned the idea of, you know, a personal God and a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really kept me attached to that was the incredibly powerful experiences I'd had.
Right.
You know, especially when I was involved with those charismatic traditions and I was a missionary with a charismatic organization, you know, just the powerful personal experiences where I felt like, you know, God was right in my midst, you know, in my heart, in my mind, in my body, you know, speaking to me, intense feelings of connectedness and love and joy.
Mm-hmm.
Like those kinds of things were kind of the last, I guess the last thread really keeping me attached, the idea of God and, you know, spirituality through a Christian lens, even if it was a extremely heterodox, heretical one where I'm going to, you know, tell the church that they're wrong about so many things.
Yeah.
You know, I was still very much attached to the basic idea of the Christian God because of those experiences. And so, you know, again, reaching out and learning more about things that you're not going to learn about in church, you know, I looked into the psychology of those sorts of experiences. And the thing that blew me away was that the exact same sorts of experiences, you know, the feeling of connectedness, of peace, of joy, like feeling the presence of God in your midst, in your body, you know, those exact same types of experiences had been described by Muslims.
Mm, yeah.
And by Hindus and Buddhists and, you know, neo-pagans. And so that was, I was like, huh. In terms of, you know, any remnants of Christian theology that were left in my head about, you know, there's a God who made everything and Jesus is his son and this is how you're connected. And that's when that thread finally broke. And I was like, okay, I cannot deny these powerful experiences I had, but whatever they are, you know, I don't need to say what they are right now, but whatever they are not dependent on having a specific belief system.
Right.
Because people of all these different belief systems, most of which conflict with each other theologically, you know, all these different people are having these similar experiences. And so, you know, whatever that experience is, it's not dependent on Christianity in any form.
Right.
So that was, I mean, that was a huge shift. That was probably the threshold, probably the last major threshold I crossed before I admitted to myself that I wasn't a Christian anymore in any sense of the word.
Okay.
You know, as I continue to learn and research, I actually found myself having one of these sorts of experiences in a purely non-faith-based paradigm, which blew me away the first time it happened. I'd been reading about Buddhism and I'd been reading about Native American spirituality. You know, I'd never really tried meditating in a secular sense. You know, meditation mm-hmm. for me was always a Christian exercise before, and it wasn't something right. I had really done during this deconversion process. And so you know, I decided to just do a simple meditation exercise of like closing my eyes and taking deep intentional breaths and just trying to clear my head. And so, you know, I kind of went into this state and I just started thinking about some of the things I've been reading about Buddhism, about Native American spirituality. And so I was breathing and I started thinking about my breath. And then that led me to thinking about how the air I breathe, where all has that air gone? You know, how many animals and plants has that air gone in and out of?
Yeah.
And I was like, so that was interesting. And so I was thinking about that. And I was also thinking about how without breathing, I would die in minutes. But at the same time, there are people who live full long lives without, you know, an arm. You know, if they lose an arm early in life and they survive as an amputee. And so that got me thinking about like, so in that sense, isn't the air I'm breathing more essential to my being than even parts of my own body?
Hmm.
And so I was like, that was interesting. And so I just was really contemplating these ideas about, you know, my relationship with my environment and how I'm connected to other people and other living things through my environment, and just kind of entered this sublime meditative state. And then I found myself having that sort of body tingling experience of connectedness and oneness that was extremely similar to what I had experienced, what I would have called in the past, you know, the presence of the Holy Spirit. And I was, and right. You know, when I came out of that state, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So apparently having those sorts of experiences isn't dependent on a faith system at all.
Yeah.
Because I was just peacefully breathing in a peaceful situation and contemplating some basic realities about biology and the environment. And I was able to have this very powerful personal spiritual experience. So
I always like to say that awe is a human experience.
Right, right.
The awe is just something that we have an experience of, and it can come in all kinds of different diverse flavors and ways to experience it. Another question I've got for you is, after this process, you talked about being kind of out of sync with your wife, but was there anyone who you've been able to talk to since this change of mind that is maybe not already a Christian that you've been able to tell them that kind of story? Or is this the first time?
Oh, no. I had some older friends from college that I stayed in touch with on Facebook throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I really started questioning, I was able to reach out to them and we were able to have candid conversations about it.
Yeah.
And I knew that he had gone through a similar process when he was younger, because when I met him in college, he was already in that questioning, deconverting place. And so he and I would have, you know, hours long conversations about like apologetics and philosophy. And I was very much on the pro-Christian apologetic side of those discussions.
Yeah.
His partner was someone who was a more traditional Christian who deconverted over many years. Via Facebook posts anyway. I kind of was privy to her change of heart. And so they've both been people that I've been able to have conversations with. The first time after, you know, decade plus of never seeing them face to face, I was actually relatively recently able to go visit them at their house. And we spent just 5 to 6 hours on the back porch talking about how the change process occurs and just sort of the experiences that we had and what it means to be in this sort of place. And that was one of the best evenings I've had in a long time. That was a really good experience.
I'm glad to hear that. I think it's an incredibly cathartic experience to be able to tell your story. You know, you're doing it here, of course, but to have, especially a friend, somebody that you have a long-standing relationship with, especially if they've gone through something very similar, that is really, really helpful. My last question for you, a little more emotionally fraught, is we know the world is a chaotic place and terrible things happen. And We're in the middle of a pandemic, and lots of people are probably in a position, if not exactly like, but similar to you, where they have somebody they love dearly whose life may be in the balance. What would you say to them? What is your, I don't want to say advice, but like your shared wisdom for that moment in time?
Well, it would depend on what kind of place they're in. If they are in a place of sort of questioning like I was, I would definitely meet them where they're at in terms of the sort of shaky but semi-stable ground I managed to establish of like, hey, I know you love them and you'd do anything for them. Hmm. You know, if you found out that something you believed about your religious teaching wasn't true, just hypothetically, would that change the fact that you love them and, you know, you're here for them at this time? Hmm. I'd be hard pressed to find someone who would say yes to that situation. They're like, yes, if my religion changed, it would change everything. It's like, you know, if you really love someone, then, you know, whether or not what you were taught in church is true doesn't really have bearing on that. I mean, it may recontextualize that love, but you know, it doesn't really change the fact that you love them and you want to be there and support them. Hmm. You know, if they were and continue to be a very religious person, I can't say that I would touch any of that.
Yeah.
I would certainly not want to challenge that from them. There are times, you know, even as far as I've come, where there's a part of me that wishes I could still believe it. You know, certain things, certain situations, you know, I live in an area that's affected by hurricanes. And, you know, I was getting very worried that our house would get destroyed and that our pets would be hurt or even killed or lost if the storm was really bad. And now was a time when I desperately wanted to have someone to pray to.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, if someone is going through a hard time because someone they love is sick, if their faith survives that and that's a source of comfort for them, I certainly wouldn't want to take that away from them. You know, but if someone is struggling like I was, then yeah, I would want to be there to shore them up, because nobody, as far as faith matters was concerned, nobody was there to do that for me. All the questions I was asking were just making people uncomfortable.
And sometimes I think it's just having somebody present.
Yeah.
Period. Who's there, you know, who can just listen and not editorialize, just listen. Let's try to end this on a slightly more upbeat note. What were some of the books, podcasts, YouTube, TED Talks that were really meaningful for you that you'd advise other people to go check out?
Well, first is Sam Harris's TED Talk, How Science Can Answer Moral Questions. That definitely blew my mind open about, you know, there are ways to have an objective morality where you can say this is definitively wrong without resorting to a all-powerful judge, God. Mm-hmm. That was incredibly formative. There is a YouTuber called Genetically Modified Skeptic. Mm-hmm. And yep. He posted a long form video called Why I'm an Atheist, where he does an abridged version of his own deconversion story. And, you know, unlike me, he seems to be a much more logical person. And so, you know, for him, he breaks down a lot more of the logic and the philosophy of skepticism, you know, whereas mine was much more emotionally devastating process. And so just kind of like the way he lays out certain questions that you're discouraged from asking in the church and certain ideas that you're discouraged from following in the church, you know, he breaks it down very using a lot of hard logic. So that was very useful. And then the third one is kind of a silly one, but Buddhism for Dummies.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And, you know, I know a lot of people who are deconverting may be wary about learning about other religions. And I'm not a Buddhist. Like, I'm not claiming that at all.
Sure.
But learning about a system of thought and spirituality that was just so different than my own was incredibly beneficial to me. And Buddhism is unique in that it is possible to explore and even apply Buddhist ideas without actually being a Buddhist and without actually making any faith claims. You know, some people argue that Buddhism is more of a philosophy than a religion. I find that to be true personally. Mm-hmm. And because it's designed for somebody who is completely ignorant of Buddhism, Buddhism for Dummies really lays out, like, here's just some ideas that you could apply to your life if you want to. And Buddhism actually encourages, try this out for yourself and see if it works for you. If it doesn't, great. If it does, great. Just puts a lot of autonomy on the individual. And so even if somebody is just completely not interested in any world religions, seeing things from a lens that is completely different than Christian thought is, I found, incredibly beneficial to that deconversion process.
Awesome. James, thank you for being on the show and telling your story with such raw emotion. I think it is incredibly valuable. I don't downplay yourself about being logical or illogical. I think we all experience this differently. We're all diverse human beings. And so your story is really important. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great experience.
Final thoughts on the episode. Wow. James tells his story with such feeling, passion, and rawness. I think his story is so important. It may be an aspect that I don't convey enough, but the emotional experience of Christianity, the pull of the experience of God, and then his experience of the absence of God. James did not tell me about his daughter's cancer diagnosis before we began chatting, so I learned about it in real time the way you did. I'm so thankful that the prognosis has been good, that his daughter is doing well. Imagine being in James's position. Imagine being a mom or a dad and your child has been diagnosed with cancer. So much of the discussion about the existence or lack thereof of God is philosophical. There are no philosophical answers that will help in that situation. I appreciate James so much for telling us his story. Having been a committed Christian, committed to spreading the gospel and experiencing God in a very real way, looking back and recognizing that he was a victim of cognitive dissonance and cognitive biases, and then coming to recognize that God wasn't there. That has got to be a very, very hard experience. And I'm certain that there are many of you out there who have experienced something similar. There are a number of quotes from this episode, but one that just leaps out at me is, James says, "This basic skeleton of theology that I have been taught my whole life, it really only works if you don't ask certain questions and you don't follow certain logical pathways that come out of it." And he also says, "Whether or not God is real, what I was taught about God does not hold up. Sometimes shit just happens and it is not part of a plan." For the apologists out there who deal with the problem of suffering, I really hope that you hear James's story, and rather than try to explain it away, just feel the weight of it. And know that James is not alone, that there are many people who have suffered greatly, who believed in God at the time, and yet subsequently came to the conclusion that God is not there. Keep in mind that if your argument is that they are mad because God isn't giving them what they want, imagine how reasonable it is to believe that an all-powerful, all-loving, interventionist God heal your child or stop your child from being diagnosed with cancer. That's real. Let's deal with that. I want to thank James for being on the podcast and for sharing his story with such passion and honesty. I know that there are people right now in the time of COVID-19 that may be going through similar experiences. You maybe have a loved one who's in the hospital, who is on the edge. And I wish I had comforting words that it's all going to be okay. But I can't say that. The world is unpredictable and sometimes cruel. And there, unfortunately, is not a loving benefactor watching out for us. And I know that's hard, but that is reality. And what we need is each other. I hope that you have friends and family who hold you and hug you and show you that how much they love you. That's what we need from each other. The secular grace thought of the week is to be that love for someone else. If you know of a family who is going through this kind of tragedy, reach out to them, be kind to them, make sure they know that you love them. I am right now reading Alice Gretchen's new upcoming book, Wayward, and at least the beginning of that story ties into James's story a little bit, in that Alice was around the Toronto Blessing, and that was a very, very charismatic environment and experience, and she's describing being a child and the pressure to be slain in the spirit. Anyway, I just think that's another aspect that we don't talk about often, is the expectation that is clearly, implicitly expressed to children and people within the church of how they ought to behave to show God's realness, when in fact, God is not there. And the pressure to be honest and integrous with yourself is very challenging. Alice's book will be coming out on February 2nd, and I will be releasing a episode with her on February 1st. So look for that coming up. Until then, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for the footnotes. The beat is called Waves from Makai Beats. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can promote it on your social media. You can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast application, and you can rate and review it on podchaser.com. If you have audio engineering expertise and you'd be interested in participating in the Graceful Atheist podcast, get in touch with me. Have you gone through a faith transition and do you need to tell your story? Reach out. If you are a creator or work in the deconstruction, deconversion, or secular humanism spaces and would like to be on the podcast, just ask. If you'd like to financially support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. To find me, you can Google Graceful Atheist. You can Google Secular Grace. You can send me an email, gracefulatheist@gmail.com. Or you can check out the website, gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.